Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 272. Today, the Amateur Traveler does a little different type of trip as we do volunteer travel in West Africa with Mercy Ships. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's very interesting interview, I have three news stories for you. And I'm just going to skip over the person who said to the TSA that he had a bomb in his bag. Just don't do that. Similarly stupid is probably the person who was detained at Boston's Logan Airport because he claimed to be an air marshal. The actual air marshal on the flight didn't find that particularly amusing. He was arrested. And then, speaking of people who are not amused, the flight crew on an LA-bound flight pressed the panic button because three passengers performed a prayer ritual. Now, I know what you're thinking. They weren't Muslim passengers. They were Mexican nationals, and they were tying leather straps and small wooden boxes to their body. They were phylacteries, is the term that I know, but basically they were Orthodox Jews involved in the prayers. They were met at the airport by FBI and customs officials, but were released and sent on their way. And this I found interesting. You know that the cost of fuel is going up and causing a similar rise in airline prices. American Airlines is trying to cut the weight of their beverage carts by 12 pounds. They think that 12 pounds will cause them to save enough fuel once you multiply that by all the planes and all the carts to save $5 million a year. For links to all of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome to the show Chris Guillebeau from Art of Nonconformity, who's come to talk to us about his travels in West Africa. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Oh, so great to have you on. So you did a little unusual travel in West Africa here a while back. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I've been traveling for quite a long time, I guess about 10 years pretty actively, but West Africa is really where it started for me. That was the kind of off-the-grid place that I went to first and really became comfortable traveling in the developing world. So I think it was in 2002, my wife and I moved to Freetown, Sierra Leone, and we were working with a medical NGO called Mercy Ships. And we initially had a two-year commitment that ended up going to 3 years and then 4 years. So we spent about 4 years, 2002 to 2006, deployed on a hospital ship that was based off the coast of Freetown, Sierra Leone for about a year, and then Monrovia, Liberia for about a year, a couple other countries in the region for the other 2 years. So it was like a four-year combined experience of living in partially and then also traveling in partially West Africa. So it was just it was a great experience. It was transformative. It was challenging and difficult in some ways, but also very rewarding in other ways. So it was definitely something that has helped me in the years since as I've traveled to many other places.
And when we talk about Mercy Ships, I think a lot of people have probably heard about them, or even like me, had friends or relatives who've been involved with them. But we're basically talking about floating hospital ships.
That's correct. Yeah. And the idea is to deploy these ships. And right now there's just one big active ship called the Africa Mercy. But back in the day, there was another ship called the Anastasis. And the idea is to deploy these ships to parts of the world where some specific kinds of healthcare are not normally available, especially in post-war or post-conflict settings like Sierra Leone and Liberia. We went to both of those countries right after the Civil War. And the doctors that come are not doing anything that would normally be done in the countries that would normally be available. They're usually doing specific surgical services like cleft lip and palate repair, BBF or fistula repair for women, cataract surgery, tumor removal, those kind of things. So, you know, doctors and surgeons are doing that, of course. And then the ship is a whole big operation that needs all kinds of people to go and support it. So my wife and I were part of the support team.
You were not part of the medical team, as I
correct. That's right.
Understand your background. Okay.
Right. I had never really had a real job, so it probably wasn't good for me to be a part of the surgical team.
They never even let you just, you know, pinch hit a little bit in the surgery.
No, and okay. It was probably for the better.
That's probably just as well. Okay. Now, this is a little odd because I know as we were talking about what destinations we could do, you're not necessarily recommending that everybody pack up and immediately move to Sierra Leone, for instance.
Correct, yes. And especially at the time we were there, it was right after the Civil War. Now, there is a lot of natural beauty there. There's some amazing people. But at the same time, when you're going to a place that is very impoverished, I don't necessarily think it's always the best thing to just kind of fly in and hang out or whatever. So, you know, in our situation, we wanted to do something to help. We wanted to be a part of a solution. We had read about this 8-year-long civil war, and the country was just coming out of it and beginning to rebuild. And we thought, like, how can we be a part of that and not a hindrance? You know, so that's why we heard about a great organization that had a history there that had a strong operation. So we wanted to kind of go and support that. But it was really, I mean, we were very fortunate that we could do it, because then we did get to, you know, live in the country and really spend an extended time in a place where most people don't get to go. So it was great for us as well.
And tell us more about the country. What kind of impression were you left with of, actually, I think the two we talked about were Sierra Leone and Liberia.
Yeah, both just fantastically interesting, beautiful places. Before we went to Sierra Leone, that was our first stop in Africa. And both of us had been interested in Africa before, but it was just kind of this vague notion. You know, it's such a huge continent with 52 countries and many different cultures. So we really didn't know a whole lot of what to expect. And we'd read about the situation in Sierra Leone and read about what was happening there. But we had actually sailed into Freetown, Sierra Leone, from Europe. So we had like a week to kind of go down and prepare. And the weather kept getting warmer and then the sea calmer. And finally, you know, we arrived in Freetown, and that was just our first impression of Africa. And there were, you know, hundreds of Sierra Leoneans on the dock, you know, waiting to welcome our arrival. And you could look out and see the city, which on the one hand was beautiful. On the other hand, it was quite devastated because a lot of the buildings had been destroyed. So it just made a very powerful impression. And then I think it was either later that day or the next day when we actually got to go out in a Land Rover and drive around the city. And again, just very eye-opening, kind of this blend of a lot of emotion that hits you all at once, because you see a lot of good things and a lot of natural beauty and a lot of smiling people, but then you also realize how impoverished it is. So it's kind of like we would go out during the day and we'd come back and we have to process it all and kind of debrief, you know, and talk about what we had seen and how this had impacted us and how we were hopefully a part of making something better for the future.
And you had some preparation on the way down. They told you a little bit about Sierra Leone, I assume, other than just giving you an old copy of the National Geographic.
Sure.
But there, I'm assuming there were still some surprises.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I try to keep an open mind, because what else can you do? You know, you've never been to a place like that. That's why it's so good to go with people who are experienced and people who've been working there. And then once we were there, we're working with translators and, you know, other Sierra Leoneans. And we actually had Sierra Leoneans as part of our crew, which was great to get to know from them, because then we could go to the village and kind of hear the story, talk to people in the village, but then we could also kind of compare it to other people that we knew and get them to kind of interpret it for us. So I think our first trip there was maybe 4 to 5 months long before we went on to somewhere else. Then we ended up going back, you know, several times later. So for us, it was just the perfect introduction to West Africa, in the sense that some things were quite difficult and challenging.
For instance,
let's see, what is difficult and challenging? The traffic, you know, is something that I think of. The roads were built many decades ago, probably 30 or 40 years ago, maybe more. I'm not sure that's exactly right. But the roads were built many years ago during the British colonial system. And they're built very narrowly for not a lot of traffic. And as time goes by, you know, more people move to the city. Then there's this war and the UN moves in and a lot of NGOs and charities move in. So there's just a lot of traffic and it's not very well laid out. So basically to get anywhere in the city, even a couple of miles away, is you're looking at 60 minutes in the Land Rover minimum. Huh. And it could be much more. You never really knew until you went out. So that was a big challenge. On the other hand, it was kind of fun as well to drive in a situation where there weren't a lot of things was kind of negotiated, you know, among drivers and pedestrians as you kind of go along. The organization we were working with, they had different rules and guidelines for our own conduct, living in someone else's country and being a part of their system. And so they kind of separated rules and guidelines. So rules were things that you definitely had to do, and guidelines were things that were suggestions, but you can kind of interpret them. So the joke was, when we talked about driving in Freetown, the joke was, there are no traffic rules in Freetown. There's only traffic guidelines. not like we have a stop sign. We have like a suggested stop sign. It's like, this is a stop sign where you should probably stop, but you kind of, you know, see what's happening. And the general rule is pretty much the bigger vehicle, you know, has the right of way. And so you learn to be kind of aggressive in driving, but you realize it's not a bad thing. It's just kind of how you get around in Africa. So that was just something that was different to get used to. And then we would go to Europe. You know, we were in Africa for about 9 months of the year. We go to Europe for a few months of the year to do publicity and to restock and things. And then it was really funny because we would have the same vehicles because we were living on a ship. So we'd have Land Rovers. Right. And then we would go drive the Land Rovers around the streets of Rotterdam or London or somewhere in Germany. And just because we've been driving in Africa for 9 months, at least me, you know, I wanted to apply the same traffic guidelines, but it didn't work out.
And in Germany, my guess is their rules are rules.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Germany is the opposite. There are no guidelines. There's only rules.
That's right. You got a chance to interact with some of the people there. Anybody particularly that comes to mind who really made an impression on you?
Here's an impression that happened probably in the first 2 weeks of what, as we said, was 4 years in Africa. And it stayed with me ever since. So speaking of driving through Freetown, on one of these drives, we had done this big medical screening in this huge stadium. And we had maybe 3,000 people from all over the country that came down for this medical screening. And they kind of go through this queue. And at different points in the queue, they're seeing nurses, and at some point they see a doctor, then they see a surgeon to determine who can be helped and who can't be. And so I was a part of the screening just as kind of as a security process and just organizing the line and making sure everything, you know, works in an orderly fashion. And at one point we had to take a patient from the stadium back to the ship to do an x-ray or something. And so I went with her with a few other people in the Land Rover, and she was maybe 19 years old. And she sat in the back of the Land Rover with me, and I heard a little bit of her story thanks to a translator. And I forget some of the details, but basically she had been affected by the war, and I believe her husband had been killed. I think they had, you know, at least one child, maybe two children. And so I'm hearing this story and just trying to kind of process it. But the impression that I remember the most of all was when, you know, the traffic had stopped forever, like it always does, and we were just basically waiting, you know, for half an hour where we could move. And there was a vendor selling soft drinks who was walking down the street. So we called the vendor over and we bought some Sprite and some Fanta and Coca-Cola. And so I passed her the cooler and I said, hey, you know, pick one of these. And she kind of looked at it and she wasn't really sure what to pick. And so I was like, oh, try the Sprite. It's pretty good. You know, so she's holding the Sprite in her hand. She's just holding it for a long time. And I realized she didn't know how to open the can. Hmm. And I had never, you know, I had no concept of that here was a 19-year-old woman who had never really opened a soft drink can before, you know. So, like, I showed her how to do it. Like, I opened mine, and then she opened hers, and then she took a sip of the Sprite, and she smiled, you know. And I was like, this is really amazing because, you know, I think around that same year, the great book by Thomas Friedman, The World is Flat, came out.
Right.
I do think that's a great book, and I like Thomas Friedman. But I also kind of realized, like, you know, the world is flat for some of us. But there's still a lot of places in the world and a lot of people in the world for whom the world is not flat. And they're not connected in the global economy, and they don't even know how to open a can of Sprite. So I've been thinking about that for more than 4 years now, and hopefully it will always stay with me.
Interesting. What's the best day you had there?
I'm really not sure. It's almost like in the whole experience, a lot of things kind of run together. And I guess one of the best days would be, not me personally, but the doctors we were working with would treat women with the fistula condition. So they were incontinent. You know, they'd come on the ship and they'd have a surgery. And most of the time that surgery would be successful, which was great. And then after they had recovered, there would be a ceremony. And it was a ceremony of celebration, of joy. And we would give them a new dress. And it just kind of symbolizes their new life. And in many cases, they were able to go back to their village, you know, go back to their family. So I attended one of those ceremonies and I just found it very joyful and meaningful. That would be one day, but I could probably think of many other.
And when you say go back to their village, were they ostracized or outcast from their village because of the condition? Or?
Yes, frequently they would be. Anyone who has some kind of deformity or something, you know, physically wrong with them in traditional folk-based cultures, you know, it's, they usually believe that this happened to them because of something they had done or because they were a witch or something that bad. So then they were able to go back in many cases. In some cases, they had been left, like their husbands had kicked them out or whatever. And so obviously, you know, you're not able to see reconciliation all the time, but sometimes that happens. And so that's, of course, joyful.
And I think that's probably something we don't pick up on in Western culture, that you're not just fixing physical problems.
Right.
That you're actually, in many cases, restoring communities or restoring people to community. Interesting.
Right, exactly. And so, yeah, so then when we went to Liberia, you know, we kind of built on this theme and we used this whole thing that you just described and we called it Rebuilding Hope. We talked about how everything that had happened during the Civil War there, which was actually, you know, somewhat similar to what had happened next door in Sierra Leone, it was all about, you know, destroying hope, and buildings were destroyed and lives were taken and children stopped going to school for 8 years. So now the country had gone through this huge shock, And now the country was beginning to try to rebuild hope. So we talked about what does that look like and how do you do that? And obviously, it's no small thing. It's a very difficult thing. If you're a dictator, if you have an army of child soldiers or whatever, it's very easy to destroy a country. It doesn't take a whole lot of time or action. I mean, you can do it very easily and quickly. But if you want to rebuild, then the converse is true. If you want to rebuild, then it's going to take a lot of time. It's not going to be easy, but hopefully over time, things do happen and things improve. So we were trying to be a part of this story of rebuilding hope in both Sierra Leone and Liberia.
Now that you've been back for some time and you've had lots of time to process this, what do you wish you had known when you were there?
Chris, I wish I had known how special it was and how unusual it was. Huh. I mean, I guess I did, but at the time I was pretty young. I was like 23, and it was like I had never seen this before, so it was big and it was huge and it was emotional, but I also kind of got used to it. Okay. Pretty quickly. And I guess that's the only way you can do it. Like when you process like living in a war zone and trying to work with it, you have to get used to it. But at the same time, you know, I've had so many travel experiences since I've been back. You know, I've been to 150 countries now, but I can say probably the most special experiences were those years in West Africa. So maybe there were some times when I took it for granted and I wish I hadn't done that.
And I'm curious, what sights or smells or sounds bring you back to Africa?
You know, I go back to Africa a few times a year. And I haven't done much travel in West Africa since this experience, but I did go to, I was in Mali and Niger recently. And obviously the experience I had recently was much different than, you know,
more of a tourism experience.
Yeah, exactly. This time it was a tourist experience for the most part. But nevertheless, when I landed at the airport, I was like, oh, I forgot what West Africa was like. It's so chaotic. All these people are running around and sometimes people are yelling at each other, but they're not really upset. That's just kind of the communication style. I mean, that's how they negotiate, is by yelling at each other sometimes. And so if you haven't seen that before, you can feel kind of threatened, but you know, you just kind of get used to it. And you realize like, oh, this is like, they're yelling at each other, but they're going to be fine, you know, later. And, you know, then I go in the taxi and you have to negotiate everywhere you go in the world. But West African negotiation is like a negotiation all of itself in terms of what the fare is and where we're going. And is it okay if we pick up other passengers? And is it okay if cargo comes along? And is it okay if chickens come along with us? And I totally forgot.
Those are things I have never been asked in a New York cab. That is true. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. No, in Boston, you don't normally encounter that. Maybe you'd get a discount if there were chickens.
I suspect you would. When was the day you felt closest to home, and when was the day you felt furthest from home?
While you were overseas. I guess, you know, we spent a couple of Christmases there, and we were expecting to feel kind of, you know, lonely during Christmas time. We thought this is going to be a hard thing we need to really prepare ourselves for. And we were surprised that it was actually a really good experience to spend it not only in Sierra Leone with Sierra Leoneans, but also with other Americans and other Europeans, you know, that were part of our crew. And it turned out to not be a big deal at all. In fact, we were really glad that we had done it. In terms of a time like just feeling away from home, I mean, we were part of a big organization.
Right.
There are more than 400 people living on the ship. And overall, it's a great organization. But like any organization, it has problems. So sometimes we would have some conflicts with different leaders about how to make certain decisions. And so at some points, it would be frustrating to feel like we feel like we're blocked a little bit from doing what we want to do or what we think is right. Now, obviously, we may be wrong and somebody else may be right. And that's fine. But sometimes we had some challenges with that. But I think that's normal.
If somebody else were to listen to this show and think, gee, I want to do something like this, what's the one thing you would want them to know before they did that?
Okay. I would answer it a couple of different ways. I would say, you know, people often ask about the practical things, like how can I do this or how can I do something like this? And so I always send people to Relief Web. I think it's reliefweb.net or something like that. We can link it up. Okay. But there's this website that has a bunch of different opportunities. And then there's other organizations that are usually linked from there, which are good. I would say the most important thing is kind of basic, but for years we wanted to do something like this. We never did. You know, we got out of college and then we had a house for a while and I'm working and I had a good life. I was self-employed. I was playing music at night, but I really wasn't fulfilled and I felt like there was something else I was supposed to be doing. And finally, we just made the plunge and did this. It was after 9/11. We were depressed like everybody else was and just trying to figure out what should we do with our lives. And then this opportunity came up and I'm so, so glad we did. As I said in the beginning, it was transformative and best decision that we ever made as a couple and individually as well. So I would say probably the first thing is don't be afraid and pursue that adventure. And then if you're doing the right thing, if you're doing something that's rewarding and meaningful, other things tend to fall in place as you pursue them. So for us, we were kind of uncertain in the beginning, but the more that we kind of got closer to the goal, and then once we were there, the more we realized it was exactly what we needed to do.
And I'm curious, you've come back, you talk to your friends and family about Africa. What's the stupidest question you had?
I'm not sure. People always ask things about, you know, what was the craziest thing you ate or something. I don't think that's a stupid question, but my wife and I are both vegetarians, so we didn't eat a whole lot of crazy things. So I never know how to answer it really. It was interesting actually, because Jolie became a vegetarian while we were overseas in Africa, and that was not something that was really understood much in that culture at all. So sometimes we would go to people's homes and I would try to kind of look out for her and sort that out, because I wasn't vegetarian myself at the time. And they would often bring chicken to her and they'd say, oh, you don't eat meat, so here's chicken. So that was an interesting thing. But I don't know about stupid questions. I mean, people just want to know what it's like. And most of us in the West have no real concept of Africa. And we certainly didn't before we went.
Sure.
So I think the more people can learn, the better.
And one picture you took at the time that is most emblematic of your trip?
One picture. I'll have to send you some and you can link them up if you want. Not a big photographer as well. There's a lot of beautiful sunsets in West Africa, definitely. And there's a lot of beautiful pictures of beautiful people from the village, from the city, from our patients that came on the ship, from our friends who were working on the ship, from the cabin that we were living in. You know, we were living in a pretty small cabin.
Sure.
So thinking of questions people often ask, people would say, how can you live in this small cabin? I forget exactly the square footage, but it's really small. But, you know, it's like anything else. You get used to it and you realize you try to kind of figure out what you really need to have. And I don't feel like we lacked for anything. I feel like we had everything that we needed. And it was a small space, but that's how it works when you live on a ship. And everybody else is doing the same thing, at least everybody that you know and your surroundings. So it worked out.
Okay. As we go to wind this down, finish this sentence. You really know you're in West Africa. You really know you're in Sierra Leone when what?
When you walk down the street and your senses are assaulted in like so many different ways. And you look around just visually, you see so many different things. You see like so much, you know, African fabric, multicolored fabric, and ladies who are wearing these amazing dresses and head wrappings. And usually they have a child, you know, on their back, maybe another child carrying in the front. And the traffic is going everywhere and everyone's using the horn. That was another thing I learned, is that the horn is a communication strategy. It's not something that's used for emergencies. You know, in the West, we're not supposed to use our horn that much. Some cities even have laws against using the horn gratuitously. Well, in West Africa, the horn is like just a general communication device. You know, there's lots of different messages you can send with your horn. So you've got that going on, then just everything's happening all at once and people are saying hi to you and people are coming up to you and some of them are asking you for something, but some of them are just kind of saying hi. And I learned to kind of get on my guard because people would come up and I had to say no many times. And so that was kind of hard to get used to. But then in the other times, you would be really surprised because you'd walk down the street and someone would come up and you would think, oh, this person's asking me for money for their school fees. They're asking me for something. And really, they just want to talk to you. And they just want to talk to you about America, or they want to talk to you about life in Freetown or whatever. And then you keep waiting for them to ask you something. And at the end, they just say, thanks, have a good day or something. And it's just, it's amazing.
And then last question. If you had to sum up West Africa in three words, what three words would you use?
Transformative.
Okay.
Unique. Hard to get to.
Okay.
Unless you're arriving by ship.
Okay.
That takes a week.
Excellent. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show. So where can people learn more about what you're doing?
Hey, Chris, I really, really appreciate you having me. I'm a big fan of amateurtraveler.com.
Oh, and thanks.
Yeah, if people want to find me, I'm at chrisgillibeau.com, which no one knows how to spell. So you can also go to artofnonconformity.com.
Okay. And what's your latest project there?
I'm writing a book. I've got a travel hacking project called The Travel Hacking Cartel, which is at travelhacking.org. That's designed to help people travel for free or low cost using frequent flyer miles. So I've got all kinds of stuff going on, but mostly I'm just happy to connect with people, say hi on Twitter or whatever.
Excellent. Thanks so much for coming on The Amateur Traveler.
Thanks for having me.
In news of the community, a while back I heard from Bill, who sent me this email. First, let me say how much I enjoy your podcast and how envious I am as an aspiring amateur traveler myself. I found your podcast about 9 months ago, well, this was a little while ago, and have listened to nearly every show. It's great company on a 30-minute commute to and from work. Some of my favorites include the shows on photography, World Heritage Sites, and of course, European city shows. It's so refreshing to get a point of view other than Samantha Brown, Rick Steves, or the likes of the Frommers. Well, thank you very much. I certainly won't denigrate Samantha Brown, who gave me an autographed picture at the New York City Travel Show. She's very nice. Rick Steves, who I've met in person also a couple times, and Pauline Frommer, I know. I don't know Arthur Frommer. And then I also had a comment, and this was a comment actually left on not on a podcast episode, but on one of the other posts of the Amateur Traveler site. And for those of you who don't go to the site, you're missing daily photos and also quite a lot of other articles and some guest posts that are going up these days. But I heard from Dean, who said, huge fan of the show and have listened to all your episodes way back to episode one. Not usually one to comment on things, but since I've lived in Banff almost all my life and very familiar with the Royal Tyrrell Museum in Drumheller, and this was a post that I put up that was a fossil from the Royal Tyrrell Museum of Paleontology in Drumheller, Alberta, Canada. And Dean says, just wanted you to know that this is a Dunkleosteus skull, and I don't even know if I said that right, had the same photo myself, only with a plaque in it. And I wanted to point out Dean's comment because it's a brilliant thing, and I try and do that, but I don't always do it. Sometimes when you're shooting digital and you don't have to pay for film, you might want to read that sign later on or that plaques to know what you took a picture of. Dean thought of doing it on this particular time, and I did not, and therefore I didn't know what I had a picture of. And then also he says, always keep up the amazing work. Always look forward to listening to the Amateur Traveler and This Week in Travel podcasts. I, like you, am subscribed to 70-plus podcasts. So Dean is another fellow podcast addict, but yours is definitely at the top of the list. And thanks very much, Dean. With that, we're going to bring this episode of the Amateur Traveler to a close. But I would encourage you to go over to the site and see what other content you may be missing. I'm also encouraging people to write guest posts for the Amateur Traveler. If you've subscribed to the newsletter in last issue and in the next issue, I put some information about some ideas for guest posts. And if you have a comment, you can leave it on this episode at amateurtraveler.com, or you can drop me an email to host@amateurtraveler.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one.